Friday, the weekly anniversary of the day they met. He was a terrific dancer and allowed that he had been on American Bandstand when he was a teenager. Whenever Valerie had to travel on business, she would find a bottle of wine waiting for her in her hotel room. "Are you sure you're not married?" Valerie asked. Just before O'Neill moved to Washington, a female agent pulled Valerie aside at the Bureau Christmas party and told her about O'Neill's family in New Jersey. "That's not possible," said Valerie. "We're getting married. He asked my father for my hand." While he was courting Valerie, O'Neill had a girlfriend in Washington, Mary Lynn Stevens, who worked at the Pentagon Federal Credit Union. He had asked her for an exclusive relationship 2 years before, when she visited him in Chicago on New Year's Eve. Mary Lynn found out about Valerie when she happened to hear a message on O'Neill's answering machine. She confronted him, and he dropped to his knees begging forgiveness, promising he would never see Valerie again. But when Mary Lynn got back to Washington, her hairdresser, who happened to be from Atlantic City, filled her in about O'Neill's wife. O'Neill explained that he was still talking to the lawyers. He hadn't wanted to endanger his relationship with Mary Lynn by revealing a marriage that was over except for the last legal details. He had said much the same to Valerie James. Soon after he got to Washington, he met another woman, Anna DiBattista, a stylish blonde who was working in the defense industry. She knew he was married from the beginning. A co-worker informed her. But O'Neill never let her know about his other women. Anna's priest warned her, "This guy is never going to marry you. He's never going to get an annulment." And yet one day O'Neill told her he had gotten the annulment after all, which was a lie. "I know how much that means to you," he told her. Often he spent part of the night with Mary Lynn and the rest of it with Anna. "I don't think he ever stayed later than 5 or 6 a.m., said Mary Lynn. "I never made him breakfast." In the meantime, he kept his relationship with Valerie in Chicago alive. All three women were under the impression that he intended to marry them. He was also obsessed with a beautiful, high-powered woman in the Justice Department who was married, a fact that caused him endless despair. In an odd way, his protean domestic drama paralleled that of his quarry, Osama bin Laden. Perhaps if O'Neill had lived in a culture that sanctioned multiple marriages, he would have created such a harem. But he was furtive by nature, thriving on dangerous secrets and innovative lies. His job, of course, gave him the perfect cover, since he could always disappear for days on some classified mission. There was a side of him that sought the solace of a committed relationship, which he seemed closest to achieving with Valerie James. When O'Neill moved to New York, Val joined him. They got an apartment in Stuyvesant Town. He was so fond of her two grown children that friends mistook them for his, and when her first grandchild came along and needed babysitting, O'Neill stayed home with the baby so Val could go to work. They settled into a routine. On Tuesday mornings, they left their clothes at the laundromat and went for a run. Every Saturday morning, O'Neill would treat himself to a haircut and a hot shave. On Sundays, he and Val experimented with churches and sometimes explored the city on bicycles. Often when he came in late at night, smashed after entertaining cops from Venezuela or Uzbekistan, he would crawl into bed with a glass of milk and a plate of chocolate chip cookies. He loved handing out candy on Halloween. But there was a restlessness in him that seemed frightened of simple arrangements. When Anna DiBattista got a job offer in New York in 1999 that threatened to complicate his life beyond reason, O'Neill actually pleaded for her to come. "We can get married," he said. But when she arrived, he told her she couldn't move in with him right away. He said there were linguists staying in his apartment. With each woman, he lived a different life. He managed to keep his social circles separate, so one group of friends knew him with Val, another with Anna, another with Mary Lynn. He took them to different restaurants and even to different countries on vacation. "Jazz was his thing," said Val. With Anna, he listened to Andrea Bocelli. "Our song was Time to Say Goodbye," she recalled. Mary Lynn introduced him to grand opera. "He flew all the way from California when I invited him to Mephisto." His politics were also flexible, tending to conform to the views of his companion at the time, a moderate Democrat with one, a moderate Republican with another. On holidays, he went home to New Jersey to visit his parents and to see his wife and children. Although he had been separated from Christine for many years, he never got a divorce. He explained to his friends who knew about his family that it was a Catholic thing. He continued to support them, and he spoke to his children frequently on the phone. But Atlantic City was part of his life that he shared with very few. Because the women in his life sensed that they could never trust him, they couldn't give him the unqualified love and devotion that he sought, he remained isolated by his compulsive deceptions. Inevitably, the complexity took a toll. He left his Palm Pilot in Yankee Stadium. It was filled with police contacts from all over the world. Fortunately, the Yankee security force found it. Then he left his cell phone in a cab. In the summer of 1999, he and Valerie were driving to the Jersey Shore when his Buick broke down near the Meadowlands. His bureau car happened to be parked nearby at a secret off-site location, so O'Neill switched cars, although the bureau bans the use of an official vehicle for personal reasons. Still, O'Neill's infraction might have been overlooked had he not let Valerie enter the building to use the toilet. She had no idea what the place was. When the FBI learned about the violation, apparently from a spiteful agent who had been caught using the site as an auto repair shop, O'Neill was reprimanded and docked 15 days' pay. That was a penalty O'Neill could scarcely afford. He had always been a showy host, grabbing every tab, even going so far as to tear another agent's money in half when he offered to split the bill. These gestures mounted up. An agent who did his taxes noted O'Neill's credit card debt and observed, "Gee, John, you'd be a candidate for recruitment." O'Neill was also paying the mortgage on his wife's house and dipping into his retirement funds and borrowing money from wealthy friends who held promissory notes that he had to disclose. Anyone with that much liability would normally come under scrutiny as a security risk. He was insecure, deceptive, and potentially compromised. He was also driven, resourceful, and brilliant. For better or worse, this was the man America now depended on to stop Osama bin Laden. Iraq was an unlikely ally in al-Qaeda's war on the West, but there had been a series of contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda since the end of the first Gulf War. Saddam Hussein sought allies to salvage his shattered regime, and the radical Islamists at least shared his longing for revenge. In 1992, Hassan al-Turabi arranged a meeting between the Iraqi intelligence service and al-Qaeda with the goal of creating a common strategy for deposing pro-Western Arab governments. The Iraqi delegation met with bin Laden and flattered him, claiming that he was the prophesied Mahdi, the savior of Islam. They wanted him to stop backing anti-Saddam insurgents. Bin Laden agreed, but in return he asked for weapons and training camps inside Iraq. That same year, Zawahiri traveled to Baghdad, where he met the Iraqi dictator in person. But there is no evidence that Iraq ever supplied al-Qaeda with weapons or camps, and soon bin Laden resumed his support of Iraqi dissidents. Talks continued intermittently, however. When bin Laden issued his fatwa against America in 1998, Iraqi intelligence officials flew to Afghanistan to discuss with Zawahiri the possibility of relocating al-Qaeda to Iraq. Bin Laden's relations with the Taliban were strained at the time, and several senior members of al-Qaeda were in favor of seeking a new haven. Bin Laden opposed this notion, since he didn't want to be indebted to the Iraqi tyrant. In September 1999, Zawahiri went to Baghdad again with a false passport to attend the Ninth Islamic People's Congress, an international consortium of clerics and activists under the sponsorship of the Iraqi government. Coincidentally, a Jordanian jihadi named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi arrived in Baghdad at about the same time. Zarqawi was not a member of al-Qaeda, but he ran a training camp in Herat, Afghanistan. He saw himself as a competitor to bin Laden, but he had close ties to al-Jihad. Iraqi intelligence may have assisted Zawafri and Zarqawi in setting up a terror organization of Kurdish fundamentalists called Ansar al-Islam, which was inspired by Iran's sponsorship of Hezbollah. Zarqawi would later become the leader of the al-Qaeda insurgency against the American forces following the invasion of Iraq in 2003. O'Neill was particularly concerned that as the millennium approached, al-Qaeda would seize the moment to dramatize its war with America. He was certain that Islamic terrorists had established a beachhead in America. This view was very much different from the one that the leadership of the Bureau endorsed. Director Free repeatedly stressed in White House meetings that al-Qaeda posed no domestic threat. Bin Laden did not even make the FBI's most wanted list until June 1999. O'Neill had come to feel that there was a pace to the al-Qaeda attacks, and he told friends, "We're due." That feeling was very much on him in the second half of 1999. He knew how much timing and symbols meant to bin Laden, and the millennium presented an unparalleled opportunity for theatrical effect. O'Neill thought the target would be some essential piece of the infrastructure, the drinking water, the electrical grid, perhaps the transportation system. The intelligence to support that hypothesis was frustratingly absent, however. In December, Jordanian authorities arrested 16 suspected terrorists, believed to be planning to blow up a Radisson Hotel in Amman and a number of tourist sites frequented by Westerners. One of the plotters was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, although he was not captured. The Jordanians also discovered a 6-volume al-Qaeda training manual on CD-ROM. The Jordanian cell included several Arab Americans. The CIA warned of multiple attacks inside the United States, but provided few details. With the FAA, the Border Patrol, the National Guard, the Secret Service, and every sheriff's office and police department in the country on high alert, there was still no actual sign of any forthcoming attack. The fears of a terrorist strike were wrapped up in the general Y2K hysteria, the widespread concern about the possible failure of most computers to accommodate the millennial change in the calendar, leading to a collapse of the technological world. Then, on December 14th, a border guard in Port Angeles, Washington, stopped an Algerian man, Ahmed Rassam, whose obvious anxiety aroused her suspicion. She asked him to step out of the car. Another guard opened his trunk and said, "Hey, we've got something here." A customs officer grabbed the back of Rassam's coat and guided him to the trunk of the car. Inside were 4 timers, more than 100 pounds of urea, and 14 pounds of sulfate, the makings of an Oklahoma City-type bomb. Rassam bolted, leaving his coat in the hands of the customs officer. The guards gave chase and caught him 4 blocks away, trying to break into a car stopped at a traffic light. It developed that Rassam's target was Los Angeles International Airport. For all the precautions that had been taken, if that one border guard had not been sufficiently curious about Rassam's nervousness, the millennium might have gotten started with a major catastrophe. But luck chose a different venue. Rassam was not really an al-Qaeda operative, although he had learned to build bombs in one of bin Laden's camps in Afghanistan. He was a freelance terrorist sailing under al-Qaeda colors, the sort that would proliferate after 9/11. A thief with little religious training, he could be called a harbinger. Trained and empowered by al-Qaeda, he formed his own ad hoc cell in Montreal. He had called Afghanistan before the attack to inquire if bin Laden would like to take credit for the act, but he never heard back. John O'Neill was certain that Rassam had confederates in the United States. Who were they? Where were they? He felt that there was a ticking clock counting down to New Year's, when an al-Qaeda attack would be most noticeable. In Rassam's pocket litter, Washington State authorities found a slip of paper with the name Ghani on it, as well as several telephone numbers. One of them had a 318 area code, but when Jack Clunan called it, a child in Monroe, Louisiana, answered. Clunan looked again at the number. Perhaps it could be a 718 area code instead, he decided. When he checked, he found that the number belonged to Abdul Ghani Meschini, an Algerian who lived in Brooklyn. O'Neill oversaw the stakeout of Meschini's residence from the FBI's Brooklyn command post. A wiretap picked up a call that Meschini made to Algeria in which he spoke about Rassam and another suspected terrorist in Montreal. On December 30th, O'Neill arrested Meschini on conspiracy charges and a number of other suspected terrorists on immigration violations. Eventually, both Meschini and Rassam would become cooperating witnesses for the government. On that frigid New Year's Eve, O'Neill stood with 2 million people in Times Square. At midnight, he spoke to Clark in the White House to let him know he was standing under the giant ball while the bells tolled the new millennium. "If they're going to do anything in New York, they're going to do it here," he told Clark, "so I'm here." After the millennium roundup, O'Neill concluded that Al-Qaeda had sleeper cells buried in America. The links between the Canadian and the Jordanian cells all led back to the United States, and yet, even after the attacks on the American embassies and the attempt to bomb the Los Angeles airport, the bureau hierarchy continued to view Al-Qaeda as a distant and manageable threat. Dale Watson, the assistant director of the counterterrorism division, was an exception. O'Neill and Watson met with Dick Clark over the next few months to create a strategic plan called the Millennium After Action Review, which specified a number of policy changes designed to root out Al-Qaeda cells. They included increasing the number of joint terrorism task force groups around the country, assigning more agents from the Internal Revenue Service and the Immigration and Naturalization Service to monitor the flow of money and personnel, and creating a streamlined process for analyzing information obtained from wiretaps. But such changes were not sufficient to overcome the bureaucratic lassitude that fell upon Washington after the millennium passed. The Night of Power, near the end of the fasting month of Ramadan, commemorates the date that the Prophet Muhammad began to receive the word of God in a cave on Mount Hira. On that auspicious date, January 3rd in 2000, 5 men broke their fast in Aden, Yemen, then walked down to the shore. They saw the oddest thing, a fiberglass fishing skiff swamped in the surf. Their eyes fell on the new 225-horsepower Yamaha outboard motor. The men talked about this apparition and decided that it was a gift from heaven. Since they were in a state of ritual purity, they believed they were being rewarded for their devotion, and so they proceeded to strip the boat of whatever they could find, beginning with the 600-pound motor, which was worth more than $10,000. When they disconnected the massive motor, it plunged into the salt water. They had to roll it to shore, and by then it was ruined. Then one of the men opened the hatch. It was stacked with strange bricks. He thought they must be hashish, but there were wires running between them and a battery. The man pulled one of the bricks loose and smelled it. It had a strange, oily odor, not at all like hashish. The men decided that the bricks must be valuable, whatever they were, so they formed a line from the boat to the shore and began tossing the bricks to each other. Suddenly, a couple of Al-Qaeda operatives in a small SUV drove up and demanded to know what the men were doing with their boat. When the operatives saw the Yemeni men throwing the bricks, they backed away in alarm. Later, American investigators would learn that the fiberglass skiff was to have been used in a suicide attack on an American destroyer, USS the Sullivans, that was refueling in Aden Harbor. The Al-Qaeda operatives, who had overloaded the boat with C4 explosives, had removed the flotation devices from the craft, which caused it to sink in the soft sand as soon as it slid off the trailer. They eventually were able to retrieve the boat using a marine crane, and soon it would be ready for another operation. Chapter 18. Boom. The men who came to train in Afghanistan in the 1990s were not impoverished social failures. As a group, they mirrored the model young Egyptians who formed the terrorist groups that Saad Eddine Ibrahim had studied in the early 80s. Most of the prospective al-Qaeda recruits were from the middle or upper class, nearly all of them from intact families. They were largely college-educated, with a strong bias toward the natural sciences and engineering. Few of them were products of religious schools. Indeed, many had trained in Europe or the United States and spoke as many as 5 or 6 languages. They did not show signs of mental disorders. Many were not even very religious when they joined the jihad. Their histories were more complicated and diverse than those of their predecessors who fought the Soviets. The previous generation had included many middle-class professionals, doctors, teachers, accountants, imams, who had traveled to Afghanistan with their families. The new jihadis were more likely to be young single men, but there were also criminals among them whose skills in forgery, credit card fraud, and drug trafficking would prove to be useful. The former group had been predominantly from Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Many of the new recruits spilled out of Europe and Algeria. There were practically none from Sudan, India, Turkey, Bangladesh, or even Afghanistan or Pakistan. In the jihad against the Soviets, some Shia Muslims had participated. There had even been a Shia camp in bin Laden's outpost of Masada. This new group of jihadis was entirely Sunni. Their immediate goal was to prepare themselves for combat in Bosnia or Chechnya, and then to return to their own homelands and establish Islamist governments. Between 10 and 20,000 trainees passed through the Afghan camps from 1996 until they were destroyed in 2001. The recruits were interviewed about their background and special skills. The information gathered was useful in determining what kinds of assignments they would be given. For instance, Hani Hanjour, a young Saudi, noted that he had studied flying in the United States. He would become a part of the 9/11 plot. In addition to the strenuous physical training the new recruits endured, they were also indoctrinated with the Al-Qaeda worldview. The class notes of some of the trainees spelled out the utopian goals of the organization. Number 1, establishing the rule of God on earth. Number 2, attaining martyrdom in the cause of God. Number 3, purification of the ranks of Islam from the elements of depravity. These 3 precisely stated goals would frame Al-Qaeda's appeal and its limitations. They beckoned to idealists who did not stop to ask what God's rule would look like in the hands of men whose only political aim was to purify the religion. Death, the personal goal, was still the main attraction for many of the recruits. They studied past operations, both the successful ones, such as the embassy bombings, and the unsuccessful, like the attempt on Mubarak's life. Their text was a 180-page manual, Military Studies in the Jihad Against the Tyrants, which included chapters on counterfeiting, weapons training, security, and espionage. The confrontation that we are calling for with the apostate regimes does not know Socratic debates, Platonic ideals, nor Aristotelian diplomacy, the manual begins. But it does know the dialogue of bullets, the ideals of assassination, bombing, and destruction, and the diplomacy of the cannon and machine gun. There were 3 main stages in the training. The raw recruits spent a period of 15 days in boot camp, where they were pushed to total exhaustion, with only a couple of hours of sleep some nights. During the second phase, lasting 45 days, the recruits received basic military training in map reading, trenching, celestial navigation, and the use of an extraordinary variety of weapons, including light machine guns, claymore mines, mortars, shoulder-fired rockets, and anti-aircraft missiles. The targets were always Americans, either U.S. soldiers or vehicles, but there were other enemies of Islam, according to the handwritten notes of a student in an Al-Qaeda ideology class. 1. Heretics, the Mubaraks of the world. 2. Shiites. 3. America. 4. Israel. The diversity of enemies would always plague Al-Qaeda, especially as new actors with different priorities came up on the stage. Graduates of the second phase could choose to attend the guerrilla warfare school, which also lasted 45 days. There were specialty camps in hijacking and espionage, and a 10-day course in assassination. One Al-Qaeda trainee recorded in his diary that he had learned shooting the personality and his guard from a motorcycle on one day, and shooting at two targets in a car from above, front and back, on the next. Another camp specialized in making bombs, and still another, called the kamikaze camp, was reserved for suicide bombers, who wore special white or gray clothes and lived alone, speaking to no one. There was a well-supplied library of military books, including Revolt, the autobiography of the Israeli terrorist and eventual Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Another book on the establishment of the U.S. Marines Rapid Deployment Force included a scenario in which a tanker carrying liquefied natural gas would be blown up in the Straits of Hormuz at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, leading to a massive rise in the price of oil. The trainees were captivated by this notion and spent considerable time planning how to pull off such a maneuver. At night, they would often watch Hollywood thrillers, looking for tips. The movies of Arnold Schwarzenegger were particular favorites. Zawahiri was particularly keen on the use of biological and chemical warfare. He noted that the destructive power of these weapons is no less than nuclear weapons. He established a program, codenamed Zabadi, curdled milk, to explore the use of unconventional techniques for mass murder, and he pored over medical journals to research various poisons. Despite their extreme danger, we only became aware of them when the enemy drew our attention to them by repeatedly expressing concern that they can be produced simply, he wrote. One of his men, named Abu Khabab, set up a laboratory near Jalalabad, where he experimented on dogs with homemade nerve gas and videotaped their agonizing deaths. It often took them more than 5 hours to die. Abu Khabab explained to his trainees that humans were much more susceptible, not having as powerful antibodies as the dogs. Zawahiri set up another laboratory near Kandahar, where a Malaysian businessman, Yazid Sufat, spent months attempting to cultivate biological weapons, particularly anthrax. Sufat had a degree in chemistry and laboratory science from California State University in Sacramento. Bin Laden was cool at first to the use of biological or chemical weapons, but he found himself at odds with Abu Hafs, who led the hawks in the Al-Qaeda debate about the ethics and consequences of using such indiscriminate agents. Would they be used in Muslim lands? Would civilians be targeted? The Doves argued that the use of any weapon of mass destruction would turn the sympathy of the world against the Muslim cause and provoke a massive American response against Afghanistan. Bin Laden clearly preferred nuclear bombs over the alternatives, but that posed additional moral considerations. The Hawks pointed out that the Americans had already used a nuclear bomb twice in Japan, and they were currently using bombs in Iraq that contained depleted uranium. If the United States decided to use nuclear weapons again, who would protect the Muslims? The UN? The Arab rulers? It was up to Al-Qaeda to create a weapon that would inoculate the Muslim world against Western imperialism. What the recruits tended to have in common, besides their urbanity, their cosmopolitan backgrounds, their education, their facility with languages, and their computer skills, was displacement. Most who joined the jihad did so in a country other than the one in which they were reared. They were Algerians living in expatriate enclaves in France, Moroccans in Spain, or Yemenis in Saudi Arabia. Despite their accomplishments, they had little standing in the host societies where they lived. Like Said Qutb, they defined themselves as radical Muslims while living in the West. The Pakistani in London found that he was neither authentically British nor authentically Pakistani. And this feeling of marginality was just as true for Lebanese in Kuwait as it was for Egyptians in Brooklyn. Alone, alienated, and often far from his family, the exile turned to the mosque, where he found companionship and the consolation of religion. Islam provided the element of commonality. It was more than a faith. It was an identity. The Imams naturally responded to the alienation and anger that prompted these men to find a spiritual home. A disproportionate number of new mosques in immigrant communities had been financed by Saudi Arabia and staffed by Wahhabi fundamentalists, many of whom were preaching the glories of jihad. Spurred by the rhetoric and by the legend of the victory against the Soviets, young men made the decision, usually in small groups, to go to Afghanistan. Such was the case of four young men in Hamburg. The most prosperous city in Germany, with more millionaires per capita than any other metropolitan area in Europe, Hamburg was, in 1999, a bourgeois libertarian stronghold. The city liked to think of itself as more British than German, aloof but polite, patrician but multicultural. It had become a popular destination for foreign students and political refugees, with about 200,000 Muslims among them. Mohammed Atta arrived in the fall of 1992 and enrolled as a graduate student of urban planning at the Technical University of Hamburg-Harburg. Foreign students in Germany could stay as long as they wanted, paid no tuition, and could travel anywhere in the European Union. The scars of history were easy to detect, not only in the reconstructed portion of the old city, but also in the laws of the country and the character of the German people. The new Germany had carefully enshrined tolerance in its constitution, including the most open-handed political asylum policy in the world. Acknowledged terrorist groups were allowed to operate legally, raising money and recruits, but only if they were foreign terrorists, not domestic. It was not even against the law to plan a terrorist operation, so long as the attack took place outside the country. Naturally, many extremists took advantage of this safe harbor. In addition to the constitutional barriers that stood in the way of investigating the radical groups, there were internal cautions as well. The country had suffered in the past from xenophobia, racism, and an excess of police power. Any action that summoned up such ghosts was taboo. The federal police preferred to concentrate their efforts on native right-wing elements, paying little attention to the foreign groups. Germany feared itself, not others. The unspoken compact that the Germans made with the radical foreign elements inside their country was that if Germans themselves were not attacked, they would be left alone. In recoiling from its own extremist past, Germany inadvertently became the host of a new totalitarian movement. The radical Islamists had little in common with the Nazi enterprise. Although they would often be accused of being a fascistic cult, the resentment that burned inside the Al-Quds Mosque, where Atta and his friends gathered, had not been honed into a keen political agenda. But like the Nazis, who were born in the shame of defeat, the radical Islamists shared a fanatical determination to get on top of history after being underfoot for so many generations. Although Atta had only vaguely socialist ideas of government, he and his circle filled up the disavowed political space that the Nazis left behind. One of Atta's friends, Munir al-Mutasaddiq, referred to Hitler as a good man. Atta himself often said that the Jews controlled the media, banks, newspapers, and politics from their world headquarters in New York City. Moreover, he was convinced that the Jews had planned the wars in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Chechnya as a way of holding back Islam. He believed that Monica Lewinsky was a Jewish agent sent to undermine Clinton, who had become too sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. The extreme rigidity of character that everyone detected in Atta was a Nazi trait, and no doubt it was reinforced in him by the need to resist the lure of this generous city. The young urban planner must have admired the cleanliness and efficiency of Hamburg, which was so much the opposite of the Cairo where he had grown up. But the odious qualities that Said Qutb had detected in America, its materialism, its licentiousness, its spiritual falsity, were also spectacularly on display in Hamburg, with its clanging casinos, prostitutes and shop windows, and magnificent empty cathedrals. During World War II, Hamburg was a great shipbuilding center. The Bismarck had been built here, as well as the German U-boat fleet. Naturally, it became a prime target of Allied bombing. In July 1943, Operation Gomorrah, the destruction of Hamburg, was the heaviest aerial bombardment in history until that time. But the attack went far beyond the destruction of the factories and the port. The firestorm created by the day and night attacks killed 45,000 people in a deliberate campaign to terrorize the population. Most of the workers in the shipyards occupied row houses in Harburg across the Elbe River, and the Allied bombing was particularly heavy there. Atta lived in an apartment at 54 Marienstrasse, a reconstructed building on a street that had been almost entirely destroyed by the terror bombings. Atta was a perfectionist. In his work, he was a skilled but not creative draftsman. Physically, there was a feminine quality to his bearing. He was elegant and delicate, so that his sexual orientation, however unexpressed, was difficult to read. His black eyes were alert and intelligent but betrayed little emotion. I had a difficult time seeing the difference between his iris and his pupil, which in itself gave him the appearance of being very, very scary, one of his female colleagues recalled. He had an unusual habit. When he'd ask a question, and then when he was listening to your response, he pressed his lips together. On April 11th, 1996, when Atta was 27 years old, he signed a standardized will he got from the Al-Quds Mosque. It was the day Israel attacked Lebanon in Operation Grapes of Wrath. According to one of his friends, Atta was enraged, and by filling out his last testament during the attack, he was offering his life in response. Although the sentiments in the will represent the tenets of his community of faith, Atta constantly demonstrated an aversion to women, who in his mind were like Jews in their powerfulness and corruption. The will states, "No pregnant woman or disbelievers should walk in my funeral or ever visit my grave. No woman should ask forgiveness of me. Those who will wash my body should wear gloves so that they do not touch my genitals." The anger that this statement directs at women and its horror of sexual contact invites the thought that Atta's turn to terror had as much to do with his own conflicted sexuality as it did with the clash of civilizations. Mohammed Atta, Ramzi bin al-Shib, Marwan al-Shehi, and Ziad Jarrah, the four friends from Hamburg, arrived in the Khaldan camp in November 1999 for a preliminary training course. They came at a propitious moment. In the 3 years since Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had proposed his planes operation to bin Laden in a cave in Tora Bora, al-Qaeda had been researching a plan to strike the American homeland. Mohammed envisioned two waves of hijacked planes, five from the East Coast and five from Asia. Nine of the planes would crash into selected targets, such as the CIA, the FBI, and nuclear plants. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself would pilot the last plane. He would kill all the men aboard, then make a proclamation condemning American policy in the Middle East. Finally, he would land the plane and set the women and children free. Bin Laden rejected this last conceit, but in the spring of 1999, Bin Laden summoned Mohammed back to Kandahar and gave him the go-ahead to put his plan into operation. A few months later, Bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Abu Hafs gathered in Kandahar to pick potential targets. The three men were the only ones involved. Their goal was not only to inflict symbolic damage. Bin Laden imagined that America, as a political entity, could actually be destroyed. America is a great power possessed of tremendous military might and a wide-ranging economy, he later conceded. But all this is built upon an unstable foundation which can be targeted, with special attention to its obvious weak spots. If it is hit in 1/100th of those spots, God willing, it will stumble, wither away, and relinquish world leadership. Inevitably, he believed, the confederation of states that made up America would dissolve. It was natural, then, that bin Laden wanted to strike the White House and the U.S. Capitol. He also put the Pentagon on his list. If he succeeded in destroying the American seat of government and the headquarters of its military, the actual dismemberment of the country would not seem such a fantasy. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed nominated the World Trade Center, which his nephew Ramzi Youssef had failed to bring down in the bombing 6 years earlier. The Sears Tower in Chicago and the Library Tower, now called the U.S. Bank Tower, in Los Angeles, were also discussed. Bin Laden decided that the attack on the American cities on the West Coast could wait. There was little money to work with, but plenty of willing martyrs. When the plan merely envisioned blowing up the planes in midair, there was no need for trained pilots, but as the concept evolved and took on the brilliance of its eventual design, it became clear that the plane's operation would require a disciplined group with skills that might take years to develop. Bin Laden assigned four of his most reliable men to be a part of the operation. Yet none of the four men could fly, nor could they speak English, which was required for a pilot's license. They had no experience living in the West. Mohammed tried to tutor them. He taught them English phrases and collected brochures for flight schools in the United States. They played flight simulator computer games and watched Hollywood movies featuring hijackings. But the gap between the abilities of the men involved and the grandeur of the mission must have been deflating. Nawaf al-Hazmi was one of those men. He had come to Afghanistan in 1993 when he was 17 years old. He was strongly built, with a quick and handsome smile. His father was a wealthy grocer in Mecca. His boyhood friend, Khalid al-Mihdar, was also from a prominent Meccan family. Following bin Laden's example, these two rich Saudi boys had fought together in Bosnia and then with the Taliban against the Northern Alliance, the loose group of Mujahideen and former Afghan government supporters who were led by Ahmad Shah Massoud. Although he held Saudi citizenship, Mihdar was originally from Yemen. He married Hoda al-Hada, the sister of one of his Yemeni comrades in arms, and fathered two daughters by her. In fact, it was her family's phone that the FBI had turned up in the embassy bombings investigation, and that would prove so important in understanding the scope of al-Qaeda. The movements of these two men, Hazmi and Mihdar, offered the most realistic hope for American intelligence to uncover the 9/11 conspiracy. Because they were Saudi citizens, both Hazmi and Mihdar easily obtained U.S. visas. They didn't even have to apply in person. For the other two prospective hijackers, both Yemenis, the situation was different. Immigration authorities believed that Yemenis were far more likely to disappear into the illegal underground once they arrived in the United States, so they were routinely turned down when they sought visas. Stymied by the inability to get all of his men into America, bin Laden sent them instead to Southeast Asia to study the possibility of carrying out Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's scheme of simply blowing up American airliners in midair. At that point, the grand plan of attacking the American homeland seemed to have been shelved. That is the moment when Mohammed Atta and his friends first showed up in Afghanistan. Their arrivals were staggered over a 2-week period at the end of November, when the leaves were dropping and Ramadan was about to begin. Abu Hafs spotted them immediately, educated, technical men, with English skills ranging from rudimentary to fluent. They did not need to be told how to live in the West. Visas would be no problem. All they needed was to learn how to fly and to be willing to die. By the time bin Ashib arrived, Atta, Jarrah, and Shehi told him that they had been picked for a secret, undisclosed mission. The four of them were invited to a Ramadan feast with bin Laden himself. They discussed the Taliban, and bin Laden asked about the conditions of Muslims living in Europe. Then he informed them that they would be martyrs. Their instructions were to return to Germany and apply to flight schools in the United States. There were now two separate teams on the rapidly changing plane's operation, each of which would lead to a major attack. The Hamburg cell reported their passports lost or stolen in order to cover up their trip to Afghanistan. Meantime, the four men who had originally been selected for the plane's operation went to Kuala Lumpur. Besides Khalid al-Mihtar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, there were the two Yemenis, Abu Bara and Tufik bin Attash, who adopted the name Khalad. Khalad was another elusive but highly significant figure in al-Qaeda. He wore a metal prosthesis in place of the right leg he had lost while fighting against Ahmad Shah Massoud's Northern Alliance. Although he was born in Yemen, he was raised in Saudi Arabia, and he had known bin Laden since he was a child. He had been part of the embassy bombing and the failed attempt to blow up USS the Sullivans in the Aden Harbor, and he would be the mastermind behind the bombing of the USS Cole 10 months later. At the end of 1999, Khalad telephoned Mihtar and summoned him to a meeting in Kuala Lumpur. It was the only time that members of the two teams would be together. The NSA picked up a conversation from the phone of Mihtar's father-in-law, Ahmed al-Hada, in Yemen, the one that al-Qaeda used as a message board, in which the forthcoming meeting in Malaysia was mentioned, along with the full name of Khalid al-Mihtar and the first names of two other participants, Nawaf and Salam. The NSA had information from the same phone that Nawaf's last name was Hazmi, although the agency did not check its own database. Something nefarious might be afoot, the NSA reported, but it did not pursue the matter further. The CIA already had the names of Mihtar and Hazmi, however. Saeed Badib, Prince Turkey's chief analyst in Saudi intelligence, had previously alerted his American colleagues that they were members of al-Qaeda in one of the monthly meetings in Riyadh. Armed with this knowledge, the CIA broke into Mihtar's hotel room in Dubai, where he had stopped on his way to Malaysia. The American agents photographed his passport, then faxed it to Alex Station. Inside the passport was the critical information that Mihtar had a multi-entry American visa due to expire in April. Alex Station notified various intelligence agencies around the world, saying, "We need to continue the effort to identify these travelers and their activities to determine if there is any true threat posed." The same cable said that the FBI had been alerted to the Malaysia meeting and that the Bureau had been given copies of Mihtar's travel documents. That turned out not to be true. The CIA asked Malaysian authorities to provide surveillance of the meeting in Kuala Lumpur, which took place on January 5th at a secluded condominium in a resort overlooking a golf course designed by Jack Nicklaus. The condo was owned by Yazid Sufat, the Malaysian businessman who had worked with Zawahri to cultivate anthrax spores. The meeting was not wiretapped, so the opportunity to discover the plots that culminated in the bombing of the USS Cole and the 9/11 attack was lost. Without Mike Scheuer's sleepless vigilance, Alex Station had lost its edge. He was still sitting in the library, waiting to be used. There was a cable that same day from Riyadh Station to Alex Station concerning Mihtar's American visa. One of the FBI agents assigned to Alec, Doug Miller, read the cable and drafted a memo requesting permission to advise the FBI of the Malaysia meeting and the likelihood that one or more of the terrorists would be traveling soon to the United States. Such permission was required before transmitting intelligence from one organization to another. Miller was told, "This is not a matter for the FBI." Miller followed up a week later by querying Tom Wilshire, a CIA deputy chief, who was assigned to FBI headquarters. Wilshire's job was ostensibly to facilitate the passage of information from the agency to the Bureau. Miller sent him the memo he had drafted and asked, "Is this a no-go, or should I remake it in some way?" Wilshire never responded. After that, Miller forgot about the matter. Special Branch, the Malaysian Secret Service, photographed about a dozen al-Qaeda associates entering the condo and visiting internet cafes. On January 8, Special Branch notified the CIA station chief in Thailand that three of the men from the meeting, Midhar, Hazmi, and Khalad, were flying to Bangkok. There, as it happened, Khalad would meet with the bombers of the USS Cole. But the CIA failed to alert anyone that the men should be followed. Nor did the agency notify the State Department to put Midhar's name on a terror watch list so that he would be stopped or placed under surveillance if he entered the United States. 3 months later, the CIA learned that Hazmi had flown to Los Angeles on January 15, 2000. Had it checked the flight manifest, it would have noticed that Midhar was traveling with him. The agency neglected to inform either the FBI or the State Department that at least one known al-Qaeda operative was in the country. Why would the CIA, knowing that Midhar and Hazmi were al-Qaeda operatives, that they had visas to the United States, and that at least one of them had actually arrived on American soil, withhold this information from other government agencies? As always, the CIA feared that prosecutions resulting from specific intelligence might compromise its relationship with foreign services. But there were safeguards to protect confidential information, and the FBI worked routinely with the agency on similar operations. The CIA's experience with John O'Neill, however, was that he would demand complete control of any case that touched on an FBI investigation, as this one certainly did. There were many in the agency, not just the sideline Scheuer, who hated O'Neill and feared that the FBI was too blundering and indiscriminate to be trusted with sensitive intelligence. And so the CIA may have decided to hide the information in order to keep O'Neill off the case. Several of O'Neill's subordinates strongly endorsed this theory. There may have been other reasons the CIA protected information that it was obliged to give to the Bureau. Some other members of the I-49 squad would later come to believe that the agency was shielding Midhar and Hazmi because it hoped to recruit them. The CIA was desperate for a source inside al-Qaeda. It had completely failed to penetrate the inner circle or even to place a willing partner in the training camps, which were largely open to anyone who showed up. Midhar and Hazmi must have seemed like attractive opportunities. However, once they entered the United States, they were the province of the FBI. The CIA has no legal authority to operate inside the country, although in fact the Bureau often caught the agency running backdoor operations in the United States. This was especially true in New York City, where there are so many foreign delegations. On many occasions, O'Neill complained to the CIA's chief of station in New York about shenanigans that the I-49 squad had discovered. It is also possible, as some FBI investigators suspect, the CIA was running a joint venture with Saudi intelligence in order to get around that restriction. Of course, it is also illegal for foreign intelligence services to operate in the United States, but they do so routinely. These are only theories about the CIA's failures to communicate vital information to the Bureau, which can perhaps be better explained by the fact that the agency was drowning in a flood of threats and warnings. Alex Station had begun with 12 employees in 1996, a number that had grown to about 25 when the Malaysia meeting occurred. There were another 30 or so analysts in the Counterterrorist Center who worked on all forms of terrorism worldwide. But al-Qaeda was not their primary responsibility. The analysts at Alex Station were a junior group, with about 3 years of experience on average. Most of them were women, which counted against them in the very masculine culture that surrounded the Near East division of the agency. These young women analysts were the ones primarily charged with preventing a terrorist attack on the United States, a burden that weighed so heavily on them that they came to be seen in the agency as fanatics. The Manson family, some called them, after Charles Manson, the convicted psycho killer. But they were sounding an alarm that the older generation of civil servants did not care to hear. The atmosphere inside Alex Station was poisoned as a result of the attitude of the CIA analyst who held O'Neill responsible for the firing of Mike Scheuer, the driven leader of ALEC from its inception. Only a few months before, the senior FBI agent assigned to ALEC had demanded the authority to release CIA information to the Bureau, and the quarrel over this matter had gone all the way to Free and Tenet, the respective heads of the two institutions. Scheuer was forced to step down, but the FBI agent who did gain that authority developed cancer and had to resign only a few days before the Malaysia meeting. None of the three FBI agents remaining in ALEC had the seniority to release information, and consequently they had to rely on the agency to give them permission for any transfer of classified cable traffic. This was true until July 2000, when a more senior agent, Charles E. Fromm, was assigned to ALEC. He never saw a single memo or cable or heard any discussion about withholding information from the FBI. When he later learned about the Malaysia meeting, he concluded that the fact that it hadn't been transmitted to the Bureau was a mistake, accounted for by the abundance of threats that had occurred during the millennium period. Many critical events occurred in the interim. When Mihdhar and Hasmi arrived in Los Angeles on January 15, 2000, they were supposed to enroll in flight school. They must have been overwhelmed by their assignment. Even finding a place to live would have presented a formidable challenge, since neither of them spoke English. Soon after their arrival, however, they became acquainted with Omar Bayoumi, a 42-year-old student who rarely attended classes and was supported by a stipend from a Saudi government contractor. He had drawn the attention of the local FBI office in 1998 because of the suspicions of the manager of the apartment complex where he lived. One of the Bureau's sources in San Diego asserted that Bayoumi was an agent for the Saudi government, but that meant little to the FBI investigators, since Saudi Arabia was seen as a loyal ally. In any case, the agents were called off the investigation by their supervisor, who worried that the Bayoumi inquiry would intrude on a major counterterrorism operation then underway. As Bayoumi later told investigators, he drove up from San Diego on February 1, 2000, to handle some visa matters at the Saudi consulate. From there, he went directly to lunch at a halal restaurant nearby and overheard Gulf Arabic being spoken. He talked briefly with Mihdhar and Hasmi, who complained that they were having a hard time in Los Angeles. So he invited them to San Diego. 3 days later, they showed up. He let them stay in his apartment, then found them another place across the street and lent them money for the first 2 months' rent. He held a party to introduce them to other members of the Muslim community. If Bayoumi was sent to oversee the two men, who sent him? Perhaps he was their Al-Qaeda contact. They certainly needed a caretaker. The fact that Bayoumi went directly from the Saudi consulate to the restaurant, however, suggests to some investigators that the two future hijackers were already under surveillance by Saudi government officials who were aware of their membership in Al-Qaeda. The CIA is the only government agency that knew who Hasmi and Mihdhar were and that they were in America. The CIA had tracked Mihdhar and Hasmi from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok to Los Angeles. Perhaps the agency decided that Saudi intelligence would have a better chance of recruiting these men than the Americans. That would leave no CIA fingerprints on the operation as well. This is the view of some very bitter FBI investigators who wonder why they were never informed of the existence of Al-Qaeda operatives inside America. Mihdhar and Hasmi arrived 19 months before 9/11. The FBI had all the authority it needed to investigate these men and learn what they were up to. But because the CIA failed to divulge the presence of two active members of Al-Qaeda, the hijackers were free to develop their plot until it was too late to stop them. The head of the New York Bureau, Louis Schaliero, retired soon after the turn of the millennium, and O'Neill badly wanted his job. Because of the size and importance of the New York office, he would be an assistant director of the FBI, a position he held temporarily while the Bureau considered two candidates for the post, O'Neill and Barry Mon, the head of the Boston office. Mon had more experience, and O'Neill had more enemies. Moreover, O'Neill's record